Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And today we're covering a topic that we haven't actually talked much about on Unfrozen, but has been covered in basically every other aspect of society over the last year, which is generative AI. We're going to talk today with our guest, we'll intro in just a moment here, about particularly how architecture, engineering, construction firms are using AI tools, and not just machine learning, which they have done for a while, including our guests, but particularly the new wave of large language models like ChatGPT and image generation tools like Midjourney, et cetera, to basically explore the limits of the field. And this is a topic that's very germane to me at the moment, because we've just published at Cornell Tech a short report that we did at the behest of a consortium of AEC firms, which you'll be hearing more of in the next few months, called the IDC, that has banded together its efforts to explore these particular tools. So it's been interesting to basically sit down and interview a number of practitioners and academics in this field who are thinking about the implications, one of whom is here to join us today, and that is Robert K. Otani, Rob Otani here, who's the CTO at Thornton Tomasetti. I won't go completely into his bio because it goes on and on and on, but Rob has been thinking about basically the implications of machine learning for a very long time. And unlike, you know, someone like a Patrick Schumacher, who was the recent keynote at a AIA Center for Architecture symposium on generative AI back in December, who, you know, has interns churning out models out of Midjourney, Rob is, I think, actually pursuing some more practical uses, including, as we'll get to, creating a digital twin of a person, which is the thing that fascinates me the most. In any case, Rob, thank you for joining us on Unfrozen.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, I guess as a starting point to level set for us, yes, you've obviously not just started thinking about AI in the last 6 months. So if you could begin by talking about really what's under your remit as it comes to using the entire landscape of what we used to call machine learning and now call just AI generally.
So I think our sort of AI journey started in 2015. And one of my developers who was interested in machine learning, and again, AI and machine learning is kind of interchangeable, at least at that time, because I knew nothing about it, was, you know, he told me that basically you take a series of, solved solutions, data points, you do some, I'll call it advanced statistics, which is machine learning essentially, and math, and you will be able to ask that group of data, which have multiple input variables, independent variables, a question, and it'll give you an answer instantaneously. So then I was thinking on myself, isn't that what people do? Like, over years and years of learning your craft, you store this in your mind, and then when a situation comes up, instantaneously you have the answer. Now, I'm oversimplifying it to some extent, and you know, machine learning is a small subset of AI. But that was very interesting because in the, you know, design, architecture, engineering space, we face that problem every day. We're tasked with solving a problem. Those problems have many sort of inputs that need to be configured and weighted in our decision making. And then we have to come up with a solution to sort of move the process along. We started to sort of create our own machine learning models, one step at a time, very rudimentary models to more advanced. And now we have a whole suite of machine learning models from steel, timber, and concrete structural design.
Well, so how are you embracing or experimenting with generative AI? Because that's, to me, the interesting difference between that and machine learning, where you had quantifiable outputs that you could then back test and then produce reliable models. But here we have a tool that everyone's fascinated with that hallucinates at will. So I am curious, Midjourney and DALL-E and others came out before the ChatGPT craze started. So this has been several years in the making. How are you employing some of those tools, or where have you found them actually useful versus just like generating swoopy images?
Yeah. So I will say, I'll back up maybe a year and a half ago. One of our AI engineers had a R&D project, funded R&D project, to train a model to learn a building code. That was the task. And we were going to try to do all this sort of extraction of the text and then try to sort of find the right keywords and then at least find the section that it was applying to when you asked that a question. During that process, OpenAI came out. And that was an unbelievable advancement, I think, in the industry, like just mind-boggling in terms of what they did. So we started to implement OpenAI into our own, we call it ChatGPT. And it is unbelievable in terms of what it finds. And I will say, so part of my sort of desire there starting 2015 was to essentially aggregate knowledge and intelligence. Again, this is through a bot, but you know that in many ways that kind of makes sense, particularly in a large firm. It's not like I can, you know, like go across the office and ask the smartest person in the office a question. That person may be in Australia or maybe in China or maybe in the UK. So how do we aggregate all of the smart things in our office that we've done over the years so people can have access to it? So we have something in our office called, we call it Spark. It's an internal intranet, sort of, you know, knowledge sharing. You know, we can share references, we can share posts, we can share events. It's just small write-ups that are there. And we decided to test OpenAI on pointing to those data sources. And the cool thing about it is that the response is not based on, you know, the entire internet, but it's based on documents that live or posts that live in Thornton Tomasetti. And so therefore we were getting not just really smart answers, vetted answers, but also who posted those questions or posted those answers and questions. And so therefore we're solving two things. We're solving knowledge and we're solving who to go to, which is critical in what we do at Thornton Tomasetti or any consulting practice. Because at the end of the day, we are how we make money is through our intelligence and our responses, not necessarily our documents. Yes, that's a byproduct of what's coming out of our brains. So once we saw the power of that, I saw that as an even more significant aspect of AI than what we were doing with machine learning models.
That to me is really interesting. I was hoping you could expand upon that a bit more about this question of like using generative AI tools as a search function, as an aggregator, and deeper into this notion of like firm IP. Because I think, of course, obviously when it comes to the field, the IP is really owned by the clients. But there is like this overall, this tacit knowledge of the participants, this metadata of the firm. And so, yeah, like how are you using AI to learn what Thornton Tomasetti as a firm knows?
Right. So again, we're using what's on internet. But we've also, and I think I mentioned this too, and it's in the Cornell Tech piece. We also started to try this for our marketing team. So they have thousands of project sheets of built projects that we've worked on over the years, you know, not since the history of time, but at least the last 20 years. Every project that we finish, we write a short write-up. Images, who was the architect, who was the owner, how much did it cost, who, you know, what key features of that project that we our practice worked on. And we pointed check our TTGPT, our OpenAI version, to these marketing sheets. And all you had to do, it was like ask it a question about some typology, and it would find these projects in seconds. That one task would take a marketing person potentially days to do. And we also hooked in resumes to that search. So then it's finding not just the projects, but the people who worked on those projects via their resume. So it's essentially a ridiculous graph network, if you will, of finding information in people. And so they love it. I mean, they won't go back. It's one of these things where, you know, this technology that was made for something or just general technology is now a very specific kind of automation use case.
AI is putting together a team.
Yeah,
that's it's literally the AI team. And you know, this is very scary for me to hear. At least if I were to project myself back 10 years, because I was a marketing director at an architecture firm, and I used to put together just these types of proposals with colleagues at Thornton Tomasetti. And it was really laborious.
I would have
loved to have just said, hey, GPT, can you put this together? I need five guys. I need them to be, you know, I need my WBE registration. The building is going to be 100,000 square feet, and it's in this location under these codes. And who's the best team under your whole network?
Yeah.
Let's put them in there. That would have saved so much time, but it might have also put me out of a job.
Well, you know, I think we should address that, right? That the issue of putting people out of a job. I think that over the years, and we shouldn't blame AI on just putting people out of jobs. Technology in general has put people out of jobs in a way. We do way more. We produce way more today than we did 30 years ago. So, as on an individual basis, a pre-computer or what do you want to call it? And I started actually like when there was very few computers. So I don't think AI is necessarily going to like decimate our industry. It will replace some people's jobs who are doing those mundane things. But I also feel like having you know heard what I just said, it also will create jobs. I think. We have a whole data team now. And so now aggregating information and data will be a really important task for us. What is things that we want people getting access to? What are things that we don't want people to get access to? It's private or confidential or whatever that might be. And also just, kind of as you said, Greg, about having the sort of digital twin of a person. I actually believe in some of that. You know, it's not going to be everything, but I think there are so many things locked in our heads that, you ask it a question, it comes up. At least for the practice and how we make decisions and why we make decisions as an consultant should be aggregated. And should be available, I think, to the youngest engineers in the office.
All right. Well, I want to get into this. And as for background for listeners, of course, if you know the phrase digital twin is a phrase that comes out of engineering and factory. Siemens uses it, for example. It's the idea of creating a virtualized model, getting real data inputs from real machines. You create a simulation that has physics weighting. And so it, in theory, operates in a data model the way it's operating in the real world. And you get back to visions of smart cities from 15 years ago where like you can see everything happening in real time. That's interesting, but to me, it's far more interesting is something that I learned about in 2020 in the depths of the pandemic, because few people recall that GPT-3, which was cutting edge at the time, released in March 2020 when we were all a little busy at that particular moment, and it was much harder to work with. You had to build your own APIs, but someone did. The Serpentine Galleries in London created, I learned this from the then digital director, Ben Vickers, they created a digital twin of their chief curator, Hans-Ulrich Obrist, based on his huge corpus of interviews and writings, and they called it HUO3000. They never took the wraps off of it. I think I'm the only person who knows about it. So when Rob and I were chatting about what Thornton Tomasetti is doing, and then you mentioned that you have someone in mind you're creating, this set off, I don't know if alarm bells is the right word, but excitement, because this idea, and it's fascinating on so many dimensions, that you can take a person's corpus of expertise, model it, and create an Ouija board, effectively, to talk to dead founders of firms, former colleagues who you might have a digital twin of at that particular moment in time. Building out an organization that goes forward and backward in time is really fascinating. So that's the theoretical. But Rob, what are you actually doing, and who is this actual person, and what do you hope to do with this digital twin? I forget his name. Mike? Steve? Who is it?
Mike. So Mike DeLashmit, who is an engineer, specialist in steel inspection and metallurgy in our office. And I mean expert, I mean top 0.1% type of person. And he's been doing inspections and oversight, site supervision on mostly our stadium projects, sports projects, for the last probably 30 years. He is the source of anything that we have a question about steel construction and very specific issues about metallurgy. He's been very diligent about storing emails, Q&A, from people around the office. And so what we decided to do was extract those emails, which is pretty easy to do, actually, right? I shouldn't say that. Getting the emails is pretty easy. Actually extracting the smart bits, Q&A, as opposed to, like, you know, who it came from and, you know, emails and all that. So we cleaned it up, and we pointed OpenAI to those questions. And so now you're getting, like, you're asking Mike. It's his data that you're asking the information from. And so, you know, that really is just, I think, the small beginning of what is possible in terms of, you know, accessing people's intelligence, or at least, you know, conscious intelligence. And and you can even think about, for instance, it's a small version of it, but, you know, what, you know, Elon Musk and Tesla have done with autopilot is that too, right? It's replicating what people, how they react as they drive a car and how they see things. Now, that's a small piece. What I just mentioned to you is a small piece about, you know, knowledge, embedded knowledge. But I think it's fascinating to me, because I've been around long enough where people in the office that I mentors of mine have left the office, retired, and the only people who have that, their portions of their sort of intelligence, is people that work directly with them, which is a shame in a way. So again, we're not going to get all the way there, but even if we get partway there, that's a gold mine for consulting companies.
Well, yeah, if you dwell on this for a moment here, practically speaking, how far have you gotten with it that you feel like it's an answer that Mike would have given? Because we were discussing this in the interview for the report, is it 50% of the way there? Is it hallucinate the other 50%? And how have you trained it as well? I mean, I subscribe to ChatGPT's premium service and tried to create a GPT of me by feeding it the corpus of the book that I wrote, you know, It's in my voice, but, you know, it's still like this giant lake scraped from the web, and it talks like itself. Did you purify it? Like, how did you get into creating a digital twin of a person?
So the interesting thing about Mike's responses, it's almost like an encyclopedia. He not only gives the answer, he gives all the references that he got his answers from. So that it's already done. In his case. So I will say, after we did this, we had a series of, like, I don't know, 20 questions for him. Or as to say, he curated the questions, because, you know, I'm not going to be able to ask smart enough questions to test it. So he curated the questions. We fed it to the GPT. We jotted down the answers. He rated those answers. And he gave it a 4.7 out of 5. That's first pass, right? But, you know, think about it. His 4.7 out of 5 is my 5.5 out of 5, 5.5 out of 5, in a way. So there's no question that works, and we need to do more of it, which is, you know, which we haven't done yet. I mean, it's like, and this is like for the entirety of the firm, right? It's right now we're only using data that we have available that people have written down. But I think in the future, and by the way, if this solves a problem that we have in the office, and we're terrible at documenting what we've done on projects, we're on to the next one. We finish the project, we're on to the next one. To the point where we don't even have, like, information about how much project cost, you know, like, how long did it take? What were the deliverable, you know, like, things that are basic things that we should have documented. People don't do a great job of that. So we haven't tested this, but I think what we want to do is, because and this may be just also an engineering thing. Engineers don't like to write anything. We may just do a series of interviews. Project managers and principals, they like to talk. very minimal effort. And so we haven't done it yet, but I think we want to do at least bare minimum basic questions, you know, free canned questions that every project will have to be answered by that project manager or principal in charge, which would be a nice test.
That's very interesting, because the two thoughts I have about the data question is, number one, it strikes me that particularly the way you're using it and many others are, is that, you know, rather than go in and build new data architectures and create structured knowledge, it's just like pour this thick glaze of AI on top and like frack out the knowledge out of it. And we're going to use it as a kludge basically for that.
And you know, I personally, I think this is the direction that it's going to go with almost everything that we do. So as a, for instance, we create these ridiculously robust 3D-dimensional BIM models. And it's very popular these days to extract data out of there to create, you know, Power BI visualizations, you know, in terms of like what body carbon or just model health, or, you know, quantities. There's so many things in there that is really valuable. But if we can do those things in combination of actually creating some associations, text associations with those things, you'll be able to talk to your model and ask it questions. We're close. I mean, we haven't done anything specifically, but the technology is there to do it. We'll see.
I'm picturing, you know, I was thinking through this, you know, all the implications of this and how, you know, architecture and engineering firms tend to be organized. It seems like you were very fortunate. Well, you were very deliberate in picking the kind of person that you would want to replicate stores their knowledge in a certain way. You know, it sounds like Mike is very encyclopedic in the way that he organizes his information. But of course, a lot of the communication that happens in architecture and engineering is visual and it's 2D. And if you want to go back into history, a lot of times it's just scans on paper. It's not even a 3D model that has, you know, queryable data properties. How do you account for that kind of accumulated knowledge? Is there a place for generative AI to pick up on, you know, let's say the 2D drawings of the Petronas Towers from the, you know, 1990s?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I don't know if I have the answer to that necessarily, but it is very true that the old documentation that we have is not very smart, including the, you know, drawings that we have. And so therefore, I think what needs to be done is to take those at a minimum, let's call it images, sketches, is to take those sketches and add metadata to those sketches in some way. So at least there's some intelligence embedded in that particular document. You know, a lot of people are using Midjourney and other tools to create, you know, kind of to automate, you know, the early process of design of ideation. But that's only the image of those projects. And there's so much more, as you guys know, and, you know, architects know, that goes into why that image is the way it is. That is so many layers deep. And so therefore, I think if we really want to make that process significantly more meaningful, we have to add information to those images, whatever the case may be, you know, minimum things, where it was, project typology, other aspects, programming aspects, you know, cost, whatever. I mean, things that actually we can start to filter down to a more realistic potential.
And to a certain degree, a lot of these, you know, for those who are not so familiar with, you know, the 2D drawings, the architectural drawings, and particularly the structural drawings, which can be very detailed, there's actually quite a bit of text on them. So I would think that if you used an OCR function, optical character recognition, which has been around for, I don't know, 25 years, you could actually draw something if it was organized, in a tabular format.
That is a good point. We have done some testing. So we were trying to, again, still very hard, I think. We were trying, structural drawings are basically symbology and annotations, right? I mean, that's mostly what it is. And so we were trying to take the lines in our drawings, extracting them as vectors, so we have a digital thing to move forward with, and then associate the text with that thing. So like when we annotate a beam, there's a text that's associated with that beam. We didn't quite get there, but to your point, I think it's possible. And one of the walls that we ran into is the old drawings are handwritten and kind of muddled, you know, like they're scratchy, they're scanned image drawings. And so I think we haven't tested it yet, but the new Google model that just came out, what it's called, Gemini. Gemini, I saw some promotional videos. It was extracting handwritten text and associating that with the actual meaning, the semantics. So therefore, that might be a semi-automated way of doing what you just said, Daniel. We'll see. I mean, I think we need to test those things because you need to associate, and which is hard in construction also, is there's a lot of our documentation is in different places. There's specifications in one place. There's the model, the drawings here. There's different sets of drawings, you know, architectural, structural, MEPs. So we need to associate those things if we really want to do it well. But at a minimum, I think you need to do it more than per drawing. It needs to be like per set, you know, to get a meaningful representation of that drawing set, 2D set.
Fascinating. I mean, and now that we also have, you know, now we're generating projects from the start digitally and you know, BIM and all other types of 3D programs. So they have a lot of information richness that's already built into them. I have to think that this would be helpful when confronted with a design problem where you need to be concerned about all the inputs and outputs that go into the materials. Life cycle assessments, environmental product declarations. Have you gotten into any of that kind of material optimization, I guess?
Well, what we have done, and this is not a generative AI task, or at least not yet. We've started to do create models for structural design and embodied carbon. So using machine learning to optimize the building for carbon. As well as we recently did an R&D project that was able to predict energy usage, so operating energy for different buildings and you know, facade and materials. So we're not there yet, but I think it's very promising in that space. So I will say that we have experimented with structural design and generative AI. And this is relatively new. We're going to hopefully present this conference. And so what we did is we created a data set for a simple arch design, just as an experiment. And we created synthetically a data set of solved solutions for various geometric drivers, which was, you know, the span, the height of the arch, as well as the general shape, whether it was parabolic or circular or one other, I forget the other, parabolic. And so you have all these solved solutions sitting in a database effectively. The cool thing about generative AI is that we're able to produce, you ask it a question about, you know, a certain arch design, it gives you 10, 20, or 30. They're all solved, reliable, viable solutions. And then you can start to narrow down after that, which is interesting, right? I think because in the future, if we can build enough parameters, we can say, okay, at least I'm just sticking to structures here, and/or facades will give you a combination of designs that actually work, and then you know the architect or the owner can pick, you know, which direction they want to go, which is a different workflow that we're normally used to, where we do like two different options and, you know, may not be the best options, but that those are the two you're going to get, because that's the things that we could do realistically in our consulting fee. So I think that's an interesting one in terms of the generative aspect. You know, I will say I do want to touch a little bit on the hallucination part.
Yes. How do you backtest and fill? Yes. This is the problem with that.
Yes. So I think that the particularly with generative AI, that is always going to be an issue. And I don't know the terminology, but I probably can find it somewhere in our discussions. But with generative AI and with OpenAI models, there is something that you can modify, adjust to sort of have the models predict something closer or farther away from the documents that it's pulling from. And it's going to be a balance, because if you want it very narrow, then you're not going to find as many solutions or answers. If you want it very wide, you're going to find there's going to be a lot of hallucination. So it's going to, I think it's going to be, and you may not have control over it either in some, if you're, you know, using an outside vendor. So I think that is that. So that's one at least dial that we might have in the future in terms of minimizing hallucination. But at the end of the day, I see generative AI as being just like as if or akin to asking a principal about a project 30 years ago, and they'll give you an answer. It's about 90% right. But then, of course, you had to go verify that that's the right answer through using conventional means. And so we actually have a guiding principles document at Thornton Thomas Study on AI. And it's basically what not to do. So don't copy paste a solution from ChatGPT and paste it into your email to a client. You know, so I think it's not going to be easy, because those answers look so good, you know? And so I'll give you an example. This is a marketing. We had a deliverable due today, but the bulk of it was due yesterday. It's a net zero project that we're going after. And I'm sort of the quarterback of this submission. And so I had to help write a whole little sort of piece on measurement and verification in projects. Not that I don't know the thing about it, but I don't know all the steps. I used our DTGPT, asked it a question. It gave me 6 or 7 steps, put it in a Word document. I shared that with our sustainability expert. He made some modifications. Done. Something that would have taken, I wouldn't be able to do it at all, but it would just take a long time to aggregate to start from scratch. It was accessing our old documents from, you know, somewhere in our database and pulling out a very smart answer. That process took me 30 minutes. Right. And so that the other interesting part is, now that we have this vetted information, we need to feed that back into the loop, into the database, which right now we don't have a way to do that. But that is going to be the next steps. Like, after you vetted something, save it, put it in the right place, because then the model gets smarter, right? It's an interesting aspect of all of this, how we sort of curate our data is going to be extremely important in the very near future.
So it really becomes a case of the value of the human here is quality control. It's embodied knowledge. It's esoteric knowledge that can identify a hallucination for what it is, and basically gut check results that you're getting from your Mechanical Turk, if you will. So, I mean, in a way, it's not that different from any previous iteration, say, you know, when CATIA was being developed or when CAD was first developed. You know, people were probably very suspicious of the outputs, saying, well, how can it know all that? You know, how can it know, you know, factor in, you know, all these gravity or you know, the loads? How does it know that? You know, you would have to have someone double check it, and over time, you know, confidence builds. So I could definitely see how this works in terms of collating documentation, being checked for quality, and gut checking against your instincts as an engineer. I wonder about, you know, some of the this is the case of the irreplaceable, you know, CEO or executive type who makes all these decisions, you know, and is compensated highly for their acumen in making those decisions. I think about the kind of record keeping that the executives I've dealt with they definitely use email a lot, but a lot of it is, it would be very difficult to, you could definitely put together a documentation of their thought process because they use email like nobody's business. I mean, gigabytes worth of email. But a lot of the material that's in there is a little bit speculative, and sometimes, you know, there's promises made, how do you replicate that process? Maybe you don't.
That's what I don't think you can do it that specifically. You know, in many ways, AI is like if this, then that, or, you know, the more you know, common ones is if this, and you could list 10 things, then that, right? That's the power of machine learning and AI. But what you just sort of described is that's a very human decision-making process. And I kind of responded to someone on LinkedIn the other day about, you know, what AI can't do. And it's not going to have those unique experiences that are necessarily quantifiable, or even, you know, it's not text, it's a feel. It could be a look in the client's face, how you respond. So you're sort of aggregating all these, you know, sort of inputs that is literally could be thousands of things that are going through your mind and making a decision or saying something to a client, knowing that it's going to have these knock-on ramifications downstream. And so, you know, as you guys know, as human, every decision you make, there's like little mini bets, right? There's like little varying, you know, levels of risk, varying levels of predicted outcomes. And that's a very human thing. It could just be how you feel that day. So I don't think that's why I think AI is not going to replace that. So it's going to replace, at least, you know, in our lifetimes, the sort of mundane task. And look, what I just mentioned to you about marketing or about search, a person can do it today. It would just take them a long, long time. So it's not really difficult tasks. It's difficult from a technical standpoint. It's difficult from a consulting standpoint because it just takes too much time. But what you just mentioned about those very high-level decision-making processes, I don't think AI will do, at least in our lifetime.
So one last question, Rob. So as part of the Cornell Tech project, I wrote the sort of introductory essay with Anthony Townsend, who's the urbanist in residence at the Urban Tech Hub there, and we sort of came up with some sort of general guidelines for that, for what firms should be thinking about. So I want to vet them with you because it's sort of based on what we talked about. But one of the things we said is, you know, that AEC firms that are experimenting with this develop an open innovation strategy, talk to everybody, do experiments, play with this. Experiment with custom tooling, which I would love to hear your thoughts on this, about that opportunity cost, about like off-the-rack tools using ChatGPT versus building your own workflows and tuning or building from scratch. One thing that comes up a lot is defining the use cases. What is this stuff actually good for versus just like, I have this AI, what can I use it for? And then also the sort of trust requirements and like where the field should go in terms of ethics, in terms of thinking this through. I'm curious about whether like the field could lead in this as a sort of Hippocratic oath for how to use AI ethically in this regard too. So
what we've started to do is we've started to prototype an existing solution that's commercially available. And only as a prototype, because you know, getting data is, you know, getting data from various sources. people said, oh, I didn't realize that that email was going to end up in that location and be accessible. You know, so there's you need to be very clear about what's private, what's not private, what can be seen, what can't be seen. And so we're prototyping it right now. And I think every firm has going to have, they're going to have different data resources. They're going to have different methods of doing this. Different levels of freedom in terms of what they can do, what they can access. So I would recommend doing, you know, a certain level of prototyping, getting a feedback loop about what worked and what didn't work. And then again, like gradually roll it out. Cause I mean, as you've seen, like a year from now, there could be a different technology solution. And there are vendors out there. I mean, you know, I think the big reason why, you know, OpenAI is a for-profit now is because Microsoft has you know turned this into a business, right? So, and they get everything there. They've got you know licensing for the OpenAI. They've got licensing for the packaging. They've got your data. So Azure gets involved. It's a big money-making aspect for them. So it's going to be for companies. It's going to be risk-reward. You know, how much do you want to have these, you know, lightning fast tools? And is it going to be, you know, profitable for you to do that? It's not going to be an easy choice. But so that's why I, you know, that we're doing the prototyping and we'll see where it goes.
Well, you know, for an industry that often gets accused of not innovating as quickly as other global industries, I feel like the AEC may finally have an edge here in not only designing the room, but reading the room for what's coming next in terms of the technology that's really going to change and shape our world. I really want to thank you, Robert Otani, for joining us today. He's the CTO of Thornton Tomasetti, and he is an interviewee in one of the reports generated by our own Greg Lindsay with Cornell Tech. And we're very excited to see what comes next. So thank you, Robert.
Me too. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.